Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 109 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and a general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And the third unofficial member of our group is the Pimping Bell. Say hello, Pimping Bell. Pimping in the world of medicine refers to asking questions of your learners to try to elicit information and improve their knowledge. So when the pimping bell rings, it means we're talking about something that's especially question-worthy. So pay attention. A couple announcements before we get started here, guys. I've enjoyed reminding you all of a couple meetings that are coming up in September of 2023, in case you want to hang out with me personally in the flesh. There are in Idaho, in beautiful Sun Valley, which is this lovely mountain biking kind of place. There are two meetings. One is called Practical Dermatology for Primary Care. That's the one I'm running. And it's intended for primary care providers to brush up on their dermatologic skills. Of course, anybody is welcome. If you are a dermatologist and want something a little bit more weedy, we also have the Intermountain Dermatology Society meeting at the same time, at the same place. You can even attend both. We'll put links in the show notes for those. Also wanted to let you know that Dermasphere has recently been producing some video content, thanks to our members of Team Dermasphere, especially Laura Dela Cruz for that, and it's up on ViewMedi, V-U-M-E-D-I. It bills itself as YouTube for Doctors, so a bunch of medical videos and educational content on there. We'll put a link in the show notes for that as well. Michelle, we are very fortunate enough today that we have an author of one of our articles to come on to discuss with us. This is Dr. Alicia Schnabelin. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Schnabelin. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, Michelle and Luke. I'm super honored to be here. I think this is a wonderful thing you're doing with the podcast, so thank you. Little about me, because it gives some pertinence, I think, to the article. I trained at the University of Arkansas. I did an APCP pathology residency, kind of a landed in pathology in a very roundabout way, but we won't get into that. And then I did a derm path fellowship there as well, under the mentorship of Drs. Sarah Shalin and Jared Gardner, who are fabulous people, brilliant doctors, great mentors, beautiful people in general as well, and friends that I still call to this day. And then once I finished fellowship, I came down to Dallas, where I worked for DermPath Diagnostics for 7 years. We had a very busy DermPath practice. I also did a little bit of hospital pathology, though, as well. So it was kind of a hybrid thing. I feel like it made me a better dermatopathologist, for sure. Doctor in general definitely kept me on my toes, but I was kind of ready to focus solely on DermPath. And a buddy of mine, a co-resident from Arkansas, had started a digital pathology company called TrueCore or PathNet. And he talked me into joining the dark side with him. So I'm now the head of DermPath for that company and have been in that position since last fall.
I'm so excited that you're here with us. I could tell reading this article that it was written by people who really understood the pathology of these disorders. And my dermatopathology nerdy, like, happy place was just bouncing all over the place while I was reading this. So I was excited.
Yeah, so I'll let you two geek out about the derm path portions of this.
Oh, we shall. The geeking shall commence.
Oh, yeah.
So the specific article we want to discuss today was published in 2016 in a journal called Seminars in Oncology. And it's called Cutaneous Manifestations of Multiple Myeloma and Other Plasma Cell Proliferative Disorders. In addition to yourself, Dr. Schnabelin, the authors include Manisha Bhutani and Saad Usmani. Looks like out of the University of Arkansas and from North Carolina. So this is about skin stuff that can happen when your plasma cells aren't working right. So can we back up and explain what a plasma cell is?
Absolutely. Actually, I was going to start there anyway, so I'm glad you asked. And just to give you a little more background, so the University of Arkansas is a large, a global tertiary care center for plasma cell disorders. So we saw a lot of it there in training when we wrote this paper, and a lot of skin manifestations then also. And so the plasma cell dyscrasia is, well, first of all, hemopath in general, I joke, is kind of voodoo because there are so many different disorders and it gets very confusing. And, you know, we're constantly evolving as we learn the different molecular signatures of things, as we should. So thank God for my folks and friends in hemopath because they're braver than I am there. But the plasma cell dyscrasias, what we mean by that are both the plasma cell neoplasms and also the things that can happen from the excretions of these plasma cells. And so in the neoplasm box, we have, you know, a disease that hopefully we've all heard of, multiple myeloma. That is when you have the plasma cell cancer within the bone marrow itself. You can take that a step further. Once those tumor cells get into the bloodstream, then you have plasma cell leukemia. And then you can also have, you know, once they, if they go out of the bloodstream or directly invade from the skeleton. One thing that we'll hit in this paper too is a plasmacytoma. So OMA is mass of the plasma cells, right? You can even take that now. So we went myeloma up, you can go myeloma down. You have smoldering myeloma. You have MGUS, which is a monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. So that's before you actually have the full blown, you know, cancer of the plasma cells. You just have an increase in the thing that plasma cells secrete, right? So plasma cells make antibodies. And they're kind of fun, you know, Michelle, you'll know as a dermatopathologist, they're fun to look at under the scope because they've got an eccentric nucleus with a clock-faced nuclei and then a perinuclear Hof body. That Hof body is actually... Thank you. Yes, the Hof body is actually due to the Golgi apparatus, right, that secretes or that packages proteins. And that's important in the plasma cell because its job is just to churn out antibodies or proteins all day long.
I love the origin of the name Hof because it was named by German pathologists. And in German, Hof is like a courtyard. And a lot of buildings in Germany and lots of Europe will have a courtyard because they didn't have air conditioning, so the air would circulate. And so the Hof is the courtyard in the middle of the building. So that's the analogous structure they named it for.
Thank you. I had no idea. So see, I'm learning something as well. That's awesome. Yeah, so the monoclonal gammopathies then are when you don't necessarily have a full-blown cancer of the plasma cells, but you've got an increase in, you know, antibody production. And so that's what we mean by MGUS or monoclonal gammopathy.
That's awesome. And I loved how you pointed out the different ways that this can present in the skin. I thought that the organization of this paper was very well done and made it very useful for learning. This is actually a paper I would urge all learners who are in training to have in their little binder of things to review for the boards, because there is a lot of boards, like testable material in here. But for all dermatologists and pathologists, I think an awareness of these entities is very important because they can be the first presenting sign of some of these conditions.
Absolutely. A lot of these things present as either, you know, the first sign of any of these disorders. Sometimes they stop there. So in some of these patients, they never progress to full-blown systemic disease, but you still, it's important to work these folks up and make sure, you know, that they get the appropriate follow-up and the appropriate diagnosis at that time as well. Some things can present concurrently, and then other things can be a later manifestation of systemic disease or just a monoclonal gammopathy as well.
So you hit many of these disorders in the paper. I don't know that we need to go through all of them, but I think we should talk about the ones that you think are the most important for dermatologists to know. Our listeners tend to be dermatologists or other dermatology professionals practicing clinical dermatology, so some of them might be looking under the microscope, but I think most of them are seeing patients in their clinic and they want to know, when should I biopsy because I'm worried about multiple myeloma or MGUS, or if a patient has that, what do I need to look for in their skin?
Sure. So I think one thing that is important for clinical dermatologists to know about it are the amyloidoses. So when we talk about amyloidoses, I think we should first discuss the types, because in derm, you know, you can see varied types. So when we are discussing monoclonal gammopathies, we are concerned about the AL type amyloidosis. AL is for light chain, so that's easy to remember there. And the what happens essentially is that, you know, you get this increased production in light chains and they all glob up and they deposit as beta pleated sheets. That's kind of another buzzword there. And those pleats are what you see when you polarize the amyloid after staining it with Congo red, right? So the apple green birefringence that you see is from hitting the Congo red stain, those light chains at different directions, and then they refract the light as an apple green color.
Can we back up again? So this is back from medical school. So antibodies are composed of heavy chains and light chains, which are basically chunks of protein. And as I recall, a particular antibody is composed of like two heavy chains and two light chains that are all stuck together.
Perfect.
So if your plasma cell is accidentally just spitting out a bunch of light chains, you know, not making true antibodies, that is when you can get something like amyloidosis.
Yes, that is correct. And in AL amyloidosis, you see these folks have, you know, easy bleeding, sometimes purpuric lesions, raccoon eyes, so bleeding around the eyes, bruising around the eyes, dystrophic nail changes, macroglossia. Also, you sometimes see with amyloidosis, systemic amyloidosis, because of the amyloid depositing in the tongue. The other types of amyloids that we see in derm are your localized amyloidoses, lichen amyloidosis and macular amyloidosis. These are not AL amyloidoses. These are not light chain amyloids. These are AK amyloidoses. And the K stands for keratin, which is also an easy way to remember that. So we think there's, you know, trauma along the epidermal surface, and then the keratinocytes, these traumatized cells, push out keratin and amyloid kind of hybrid. So when we stain the AK amyloid, it actually stains for keratins as well as the Congo red, which is kind of fun. Again, we're totally geeking out on the derm pad.
Yes, we are.
But, and then
nobody doesn't like Congo red, apple green
right.
Birefringence. What's not to like? So these AK amyloids, they're like not a big deal. So if you see somebody who has, you think, the AL amyloidosis, that's a problem because it means they have like a plasma cell disorder. But people who just scratch the middle of their back a lot because they have notalgia paresthetica can give themselves like an amyloidosis as a result.
Yep, perfect. And nodular amyloidosis isn't AL amyloidosis usually, but it doesn't always mean you have systemic disease. It can be completely localized. So if you see nodular amyloidosis or other signs of systemic amyloidosis, it is important to go ahead and work these patients up and look for a monoclonal gammopathy, and also to type their amyloid if you see a diffuse or nodular amyloidosis. And this is very important because in addition to the AK and AL types, you also have an AA type amyloid. AA is acute phase reactant. So we see that in infections and inflammation, other cancers, and then also hereditary amyloids as well. These, again, don't matter. I mean, they matter, but they get treated differently than an AL amyloidosis will. ALs are always, they get the same kind of treatments as myeloma patients do. And so that's why it's so important to type them. By typing, we mean, you know, we don't really have IHC for this. It's got to be sent off to the Mayo Clinic and they'll do mass spec on it. But you just send the block or unstained slides. If your pathologist isn't aware of this, because it is pretty esoteric, feel free to give me a call or have them reach out to me or whatever, and I can help out. But yeah.
That's great. That's a great review of amyloidosis. And that might be all we have time for right now, because I don't want to keep you too long, Dr. Schnabelin. But your article here is a great reference. I was highlighting it in preparation for this and found that almost all of it got highlighted as a result. So nice, dense information there. Thanks again for joining us. If people want to learn more about you or find out you or your company, where can they go?
So I'm on social media as Skin and Scope. You can follow me
very
there.
Cool.
You can, we've also got a website present at PathNet or TrueCore Pathology.
Excellent. We'll put some links in the show notes. And this digital pathology thing sounds interesting too. Maybe we can have you on again sometime just to discuss that with, I mean, Michelle, I kind of can hang around too, but I think that's an interesting discussion as well, sort of the future of pathology and where digital pathology has a role.
I'd love to. If you'll have me back, I'd love to. It's fun and exciting. And yeah, there are a lot of things coming down the pipeline and things that we can do now too that are super exciting.
That's wonderful. I was trying to follow you on Instagram. That's why Unstoppable by CO was playing. Apparently there was a video open on that app. But you're Skin and Scope on Instagram, correct?
Correct.
Very cool. I shall be a new follower. I'm very excited.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll see you next time. Michelle, you're the queen of the segues, but I wonder if even you could figure out a good one to go from plasma cell dyscrasias with Dr. Schnabelin to subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn. I never see one. I sometimes see the other.
Yeah, I think that would be a cute one. I like that. It involves inflammatory cells, both of them. I'm going to go with that. That sounds good.
Well, this next article is indeed about subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn, and it's a retrospective study of 32 infants and care algorithm. Authors include Liza Siegel and Sarah Chamlin. This is out of Chicago and in the journal Pediatric Dermatology, and is a CertLink article. So if you are using CertLink to maintain your certification, then it might look familiar. So this article reports the experience of the single center in Chicago over a 10-year time frame about their subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn patients. They had 32 of them before over that time frame. So before I read this article, I felt like I know a fair amount about subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn. I am a pediatric dermatologist, after all. So before I read the article, I thought to myself, okay, this entity shows up in healthy term infants generally. It appears at 2 to 3 weeks of age, usually not there right at birth, but occasionally it can be. And they're like indurated, violaceous plaques and nodules. I felt like I had seen them mostly on the trunk and buttocks. Generally nothing to worry about, but can be associated with hypercalcemia. So my biggest thoughts about this condition were be able to recognize it and then don't give them vitamin D supplementation, which looked like a fairly common recommendation, at least before this article came out. So this article emphasizes this hypercalcemia issue, as basically all of their patients who were tested for it had some degree of hypercalcemia. All of them. And they also emphasize that you should check a lab that's not called calcium. It is in fact called ionized calcium. Apparently it's a lot more accurate than normal calcium in these patients for unknown reasons. So for example, like again, about all of the patients who were tested for it had high ionized calcium, but only 14% of them had abnormal serum calcium or what's called albumin corrected calcium as well. So you want to be checking ionized calcium. So make sure you write the right order into your EMR. And then they have some specific guidelines regarding what they think are a good idea for lab monitoring for these patients, but I'll get into you. So ionized calcium, do you know what ionized calcium is, Michelle? I just knew it was a different lab.
So. Yeah, it's, I mean, isn't that the calcium that bears the ionic charge, the two pluses?
Certainly could be. I mean, that makes sense from the words, but apparently the lab ionized calcium represents calcium that is not attached to proteins.
That makes sense.
Thus is biologically active. So a normal ionized calcium level is about 1 to 1.4. And then they have some definitions of various degrees of hypercalcemia, which I guess I'll mention here. Pimping Bell, are you listening? So if your ionized calcium is normal, 1 to 1.4, that's considered eucalcemic. That's equivalent to a total serum calcium between 8 and 10. So mild hypercalcemia, an ionized calcium between 1.4 and 2. This is in millimoles per liter. Moderate to severe hypercalcemia is between 2 and 2.5, and then hypercalcemic crisis, if it's greater than 2.5 or 3.
And Luke, that is also correct. So the ionized calcium is able to bind to negatively charged sites on protein molecules. That's why it complexes. So the calcium that's not bound does have that 2 plus charge, which is actually what attracts it to bind to the proteins.
Wonderful. We were both right. My favorite outcome. So this series, 32 patients, 6 infants had some kind of problem due to hypercalcemia. 3 developed clinical symptoms. So babies, if they're developing symptoms of hypercalcemia, they describe them as irritability, fussiness, sleepiness, and poor feeding. So based on that, my 2 kids had hypercalcemia when they were kids, or when they were babies. I mean, obviously it's hard to tell sometimes if this patient's increased irritability or poor feeding is due to hypercalcemia. But if they have that and parents feel it's abnormal and they also have high calcium, then I guess that's how you say it's related to their hypercalcemia. Two patients required hospital admission. Two developed kidney stones, nephrocalcinosis, and one patient had an acute kidney injury as a result. They say no infants with a peak ionized calcium less than 1.5 developed complications of hypercalcemia. So if you check and it's a little high, like between 1.4 and 1.5, then you're probably still okay. Most of them were diagnosed with hypercalcemia and demonstrated peak calcium levels within the first 28 days of life. No patients developed hypercalcemia after 3 months of age. In the two patients who developed nephrocalcinosis, the kidney stones, their calcium remained elevated for a long time. More than 2 years!
What?
That's a long time. The good news, though, is that it doesn't really seem like it was a clinically significant issue because their nephrocalcinosis resolved upon serial imaging, which apparently is in keeping with some previous literature about this issue. Treatment for hypercalcemia in this group of patients included holding vitamin D supplementation, using a low calcium formula, so not giving them extra vitamin or not giving them extra calcium or vitamin D, which helps you absorb more calcium, giving them intravenous fluids, systemic steroids, and diuretics, though they do point out that in general, if you're stuck using like second or third line treatments instead of diuretics and systemic steroids, bisphosphonates and zoledronic acid are preferred. Fortunately, I think we can rely on our colleagues in pediatrics and endocrinology to run that bus to some degree. So in terms of their recommendations, so if you think your patient has subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn, get an ionized calcium and then monitor ionized calcium weekly until 1 month of age and then every other week until 3 months of age if they haven't developed hypercalcemia. And then if you're good at 3 months and they haven't developed it, well, they're probably not going to after that. If your patient does have hypercalcemia, they say monitor for at least 3 months or until normalization. And if they're symptomatic, or if it's elevated to 1.6 or above, or it's going up quickly, hospitalize them. And then, you know, your colleagues can decide if they need IV fluids and other sorts of treatments. If it's persistently elevated calcium levels for 6 months or more, they say get a urinary system ultrasound and do that as well if it's just extra high, like 1.6 or above. And they say vitamin D supplementation should be held in all infants with hypercalcemia. So I think that's a fairly good takeaway from this, especially because I think most of us are lucky enough that our patients generally don't have significantly elevated calcium, but they probably almost all have it to some degree. So if you're reflex is to just not give them vitamin D, that's not that bad of a reflex, but you know, check their ionized calcium level first. I guess there's probably the occasional baby out there who has subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn, or maybe they actually had something else and their calcium's okay. Consistent with previous literature, 86% of their patients were healthy term infants. However, somewhat contrary to my previous thinking, most of the lesions in this series were on the upper extremities and scalp, so I might just have a bias by the cases I have seen. And these ranged in size quite a bit, 3 millimeters to 6 centimeters.
Oof.
And this was a problem that I've run into. Like, if you have a baby who just has a really small lesion of subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn, do you still say, well, check a bunch of calcium and hold vitamin D? And basically, you probably should, because they said there was a correlation between size and ionized calcium level, but the correlation was weak. So it sounds like even if you have just a really small lesion, you could still get a significant elevation in your calcium. Also, only one of their patients had therapeutic hypothermia. I don't even know why you use that, but apparently it's commonly performed at their institution. It's a thing you do for newborns sometimes for some reason. And it's thought to be potentially a contributing factor to subcutaneous fat necrosis. Do you know anything more about therapeutic hypothermia, Michelle?
I know therapeutic hypothermia is sometimes used for certain infectious diseases. It was actually one of the chief treatments for tuberculosis back in the day. They'd actually put people in these heat boxes where just their head stuck up out of it, and the rest of their body was in this like box that was reflective out in the sun, usually in the desert. There were places in New Mexico that were like this. They also used this to treat leprosy.
This is hypothermia we're talking
about.
Oh, I
thought you said hyperthermia. Sorry. Hypothermia actually has some interesting effects on metabolism. And I can understand why it might actually be beneficial for subcutaneous fat necrosis. That actually makes sense.
Well, it's not a treatment for fat necrosis. It's for something else. And apparently they think that babies who get it for whatever they need it for have an increased chance of developing subcutaneous fat necrosis in the newborn. Well, anyone out there who studies pediatrics thinks we're a couple of dummies, so sorry about that, guys. why do these patients with subcutaneous fat necrosis get hypercalcemia? Well, it's somewhat unclear. I was taught that the multinucleated giant cells within the lesions elaborated hormones, specifically a form of vitamin D, that caused increased calcium absorption, but it sounds like calcium may also be liberated directly from the lesions. Predisposing factors for subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn potentially include therapeutic hypothermia, though maybe that's a bias in the literature. That's, you know, positive findings get reported. Also, potentially hypoglycemia, perinatal hypoxemia, and birth trauma could be predisposing factors. Why babies get it is unknown, but it does have characteristic histologic findings, Michelle. You want to tell us about the histologic findings?
The histologic findings are really fun. This is one of the things that is a little bit of instant pattern recognition. So you'll see a paniculitis that has sort of radial-shaped clefts within both adipocytes and multinucleated giant cells within the paniculus. There's usually a mixed inflammatory infiltrate, which is what helps you distinguish it from scleroderma neonatorum, which is another condition in which ice crystals can form in subcutaneous fat in neonates. Of course, the babies those two things affect are very different. So scleroderma neonatorum tends to affect gravely ill preemies, whereas patients that develop subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn are typically post-dates with some kind of perinatal distress. It's like meconium aspiration, something along those lines. And the changes that you see in the fat are different because the scleroderma neonatorum infants unfortunately often don't survive long enough to mount that kind of inflammatory response that you see in the healthy babies that develop subcutaneous fat necrosis of the newborn.
And with that, we can finish the discussion. Check your babies. See if they have little nodules.
That was very interesting, and I apologize for mishearing you about the hyper versus hypothermic treatments. I was responding to a text from a resident about a patient. I've got a little makeup clinic this morning, and some people got a little bit confused, which is fine. So we're going to go on to the second article we're reviewing today after our guest has joined us. So this is called Safety and Efficacy of Linabesum. Da, 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 da. I feel like that's how you have to remember how to say it. Linabesum. And see, that's a song from a period of time, I believe, in which cannabinoids were more commonly recreationally used. Maybe not. But this is a cannabinoid receptor 2 agonist, type 2 agonist, in patients with dermatomyositis with refractory skin disease, a randomized clinical trial. The chief authors are Victoria P. Wirth and Barbara White, and this was published in the Journal of the JID, so the Journal of Investigative Dermatology. The treatment options, as we know, for dermatomyositis skin disease are relatively limited, and most of them are immunosuppressive. We also know that a lot of patients with dermatomyositis might have concomitant malignancy, and so this is a specific group of patients that we would really rather not immunosuppress. So linabesum is a cannabinoid receptor type 2 agonist. It's attractive because it's not an immunosuppressant medication, but instead may be able to trigger resolution of inflammation. And we'll go over why that is. In this study, they wanted to look at the safety and efficacy of linabesum in patients with refractory cutaneous dermatomyositis. So this is a good time to review the different types of studies. Phase 1 is basically to evaluate the safety of a medication or a drug that is proposed for the treatment of a condition. Phase 2 studies look at both safety and efficacy. And then phase 3 typically compares the study drug to the currently accepted therapeutic for whatever condition is being treated to show non-inferiority. So this is an early phase 2 study that is going to look at both efficacy and safety of linabesum in patients with cutaneous dermatomyositis. It was single center, double blind, randomized, placebo controlled. It was relatively small, 22 patients, 21 of whom were female, and they were randomized evenly to placebo versus linabesum. The patient population was patients that were over the age of 18 that had moderately active dermatomyositis, indicated by the cutaneous dermatomyositis disease area severity index. Which is, I'm going to call CDAISI because it's a lot to say. So the CDAISI of greater than 14 would indicate moderate to severe disease. And there's actually two parts to the CDASI, or however you want to say that. It is a one-page outcome measure for the severity of skin disease in patients with dermatomyositis, and it actually has two separate scores. So there is a score for disease activity, and that score ranges from 0 to 100 and measures things like erythema scale, ulceration, and erosion. And there's also a scale for damage, which assesses for calcinosis and poikiloderma change. So this one, I believe, is looking more at the activity scale. And so the patients had a score of greater than 14. And actually, in the methods, they went over the fact that actually all patients had a score greater than 20. So these were relatively active patients with their skin disease. These patients also had to have failed or had intolerance to hydroxychloroquine. And the patients that were assigned to the active drug group started off on 20 milligrams of linabasum for 28 days, and then 20 milligrams twice daily for 56 days versus placebo. They then looked at the change in the cutaneous dermatomyositis disease area severity index, or the CDASI, and the safety and secondary efficacy assessments were performed until day 113. So they continued to study the patients after they had ceased taking the drug, and they did actually find some improvements that were ongoing. So spoiler alert, there was some persistence of effect for the patients that were treated with active drug. The patients, as I said, were randomized sort of 1-to-1, 11 in each group. They didn't have any severe or serious adverse events in either group, and no participants discontinued the study. They found that they had a decrease in the CDASI score, and much like many of these scores, the lower numbers means better control of disease, higher numbers correlate to higher disease activity. So the patients on active drug had a difference of negative 6.5 in their CDASI score. And they also saw improvements in secondary efficacy outcomes, such as biomarkers, as well as some immunostaining that they had interpreted by a computer program to kind of look at the level of staining in some inflammatory cells for certain inflammatory markers. So this is a relatively small study, but has some indication that it might be something to look at further. As we know, dermatomyositis is a rare, fortunately, systemic autoimmune disease. It has distinguishing cutaneous features that can be accompanied by muscle inflammation. To be enrolled in this study, the patients had to have a lack of severe muscular activity, because not controlling those patients with proper steroids or immunosuppressants wouldn't be medically ethical. So the patients in this study had skin-predominant disease. The skin disease in dermatomyositis patients can be disfiguring and affects up to 80% of patients with dermatomyositis, and can cause photosensitivity and pruritus and impair quality of life. And that pruritus piece is important. There's actually an increase of IL-31 in lesional skin in patients who have dermatomyositis. And as we're coming to understand more, IL-31 is one of our itchy cytokines. The erythema scale erosions and ulcerations that are the manifestation of active dermatomyositis are the result of skin inflammation, and there are increased levels of CD4 positive T cells, activated macrophages and dendritic cells, and other inflammatory cytokines are also found in increased levels in skin biopsies, including TNF-alpha, IL-1, and interferons, which appear to contribute to the pathogenesis of the disease. So the reason they wanted to look at linabasum for this is that the endocannabinoid system has the ability to modulate inflammatory and fibrotic responses. There are actually CB2 type receptors on activated immune cells, and CB2 receptors play a role in returning an activated immune response to homeostasis by activating the physiologic process of resolution of inflammation. And that actually leads to reduced antibody production and improvement of the inflammation. So I kind of think about our immune system when it has to fight a pathogen, or when it gets inappropriately activated in autoimmunity, as the Hulk, right? In our Marvel comics. So the Hulk who's gotten angry. CB2 receptor signaling is basically the sun's getting real low in the sky, Bruce, kind of thing that, you know, you can have, I guess, who is it that says that? It is
Black Widow.
Right? Yes, Black Widow. I was trying to think.
I felt like that kind of came out of nowhere in the.
You know what that's from? Actually, it's from the comics. So there's like a different version of the Hulk in the comics that started out, who's actually a lot meaner and not quite as lovable as the Bruce Banner version. He was gray. The original Hulk was gray. And then Bruce Banner was kind of the green, more like angry slash innocent version of the Hulk. So there's some thought that the sun's getting real low in the sky thing is a reference either to the work is done for the day, or you're getting a little too close to your dark side, Bruce. Calm the hell down. Anyway, so interestingly, they did some studies with mice that had a CB2 knockout. So in CB2 knockout mice, their Hulk can't calm down because they can't hear that sun's getting real low in the sky, Bruce, signal. So CB2 knockout mice actually have more severe inflammation and fibrosis that is thought to be mediated through increases of NF-kappa-beta activation with the production of inflammatory adhesion molecules, chemokines and cytokines, as well as recruitment of immune cells and reduced apoptosis of lymphocytes. So in these mice that have CB2 knocked out, they can't shut down that inflammatory pathway that gets activated. The activation of the kind of inflammatory cytokines needs to be reduced after the threat is gone. So this is an important part of our immune system regulating itself. And it is influenced by the CB2 receptor because it actually has an effect on G1 and G0 proteins. It also modulates signaling pathways and regulates cell function. So the CB2 receptor is very important in helping resolve an activated immune response.
And isn't that weird? Like, why do we have cannabinoid receptors that turn down our immune system? Why was that evolutionarily advantageous? I guess we produce some sort of natural cannabinoids that, and then just, you know, marijuana happens to also link into the same receptors.
Depending on who you ask, you know, some people who are aficionados of the plant like to advocate that whatever benign creator spirit put the universe together, put that there for a reason. Like, you know, there's very interesting correlates between plants found in nature that can stimulate receptors that we have in our bodies because we have an endogenous production of something that also hits that receptor. And it might be like echoes in evolutionary biology. And that's, you know, why we have those and other organisms have those. That is a question for the universe, Luke. I do think it is interesting, though. So the
It is interesting. And I had no idea before I read this article. So in addition to like this being a drug for dermatomyositis, also, it's just kind of cool to hear about the cannabinoid system in the body. And it's also cool to see a cannabinoid rigorously studied in dermatology, which we don't see very often. As far as the CB2 thing goes, they also point out that there are some people walking around who have genetic polymorphisms that lead to dysfunction in CB2, and they have mm-hmm. more severe inflammation and increased risk for autoimmunity. Mm-hmm. And apparently, they also cite this other study where there was a model of acute inflammation in the skin of healthy human volunteers. So I guess they must have like rubbed some irritating substance on them or whatever to create irritant contact dermatitis or something. And mm-hmm. they tried giving them linabisum, 20 milligrams twice a day, and it had a magnitude of effect similar to that of 15 milligrams of prednisolone daily.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I also like to think that to recruit people, they were like, hey, you want us to rub some acid on you and then you take a pill? No, it's a cannabinoid. All right, well, that sounds chill.
Oh my God. I mean, you know, the consent forms must have been intriguing. What I couldn't figure out from the study, and I need to look up, is whether or not this would cause a positive drug test, because that could potentially preclude therapy for certain patients. So the activity of CB2 can actually help reduce interferon production, IL-1, IL-6, TNF-alpha, and IL-17 being produced by peripheral blood mononuclear cells, which are just any cell that has a round nucleus, so lymphocytes, monocytes, NK cells, dendritic cells, versus eosinophils and neutrophils, which of course have multilobated nuclei. The interesting thing about the multilobated nuclei of like neutrophils specifically is that they have that kind of strange configuration to their nucleus because the construction of the nucleus is different. And it's thought to be like that because they need it to be very flexible to do the kind of transmigration through vascular endothelium and stuff that neutrophils have to be able to do fast because they're that first responder cell. And also it helps to make something called NETs, NETs, which are neutrophil extracellular traps that are actually made out of chromatin. Kind of fascinating. Those things are both helpful in innate immunity, but also problematic in auto reactive processes. So the CB2.
Wait a second. I got another question. So yes. Cancer patients sometimes take medical cannabis mm-hmm. to like stimulate their appetite and pain reduction and so on. But if it's also stimulating their CB2 receptors, does mm-hmm. it calm down their native immune system, which we want to be working against their cancer?
Well, it's really not immunosuppressive. It's immunoregulatory. So if you were using an immune therapy, like an immune targeting therapy, where you're trying to activate the immune cells against something, like there was the sort of vaccine therapy for melanoma, where you would kind of try to get the tumor infiltrating lymphocytes to have more reactivity against the tumor. There were also times when they were actually trying to make proliferate the tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and re-inject them into the patients. A lot of those studies have sort of gone by the wayside. But I think anything where you're trying to use the immune system to do some kill, you'd have to look at this and think about it.
We have all those PD-1 receptor agonists and or antagonists and stuff. They're supposed to work by revving up the immune system.
More by removing the block that the cancer cells can put on the reactive cells that are trying to target the tumor cell. Because remember, the problem with the tumor cells is that they can overexpress the ligand for PD-1 to sort of say, everything's fine, we're cool, leave me alone type of stuff. So I think that it's possible that there could be an interaction. I will have to look into that question further, but it is an interesting question.
Yeah, I guess in this episode, we need a pediatrician and an oncologist to just lay down some knowledge for us. Sorry for the tangent.
That's okay. I think it's interesting. So as a selective CB2 agonist that has greater affinity for CB2 than CB1, which is the one that's responsible for the more famous psychoactive effects of cannabinoids, the drug has limited penetration into the CNS, so you have reduced psychoactive adverse events caused by the CB1 activation. And because CB2 is mainly expressed on immune cells, and dermatomyositis skin has the highest expression of CB2 on dendritic cells and B cells, they thought that this would be helpful. CB2 agonists can also increase expression of pro-resolving compounds called lipoxins, which are anti-inflammatory pro-resolving molecules, and resolvins, which are something called a specialized pro-resolving mediator that are derived from like omega-3 fatty acids like EPA, DHA, and DPA. So those are increased, and then decrease of production of inflammatory prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and cytokines, as well as chemokines and polarizing macrophages and adhesion molecules. So the linabisms thought to work by helping resolve inflammatory processes that have been activated. The patients that were in this study showed a trend toward decrease from baseline CDASI to like over the placebo in the first part of the study, but that became significant after they went to twice daily dosing. So the once daily dosing didn't seem to be as efficacious. They were looking for improvement of at least 40% of baseline, which is relatively typical for studies in the rheumatology world. So in dermatology, we're used to PASI 75s is where we started, and then PASI 50s, then PASI 75s, then PASI 90s, then PASI 100s. With rheumatologic diseases, 40% improvement is often a good threshold to start with. And so they found that 40% improvement in 5 out of the 11 linabisum-treated patients versus none in the placebo patients. They had, interestingly, 4 patients in each group that had adverse effects. So the placebo group and the treatment group had the same frequency of adverse effects with a maximum severity of moderate. And those included mild dizziness, mild to moderate fatigue, mild dry mouth, mild diarrhea, and mild dizziness. The patients on linabisin were more likely to have dizziness and dry mouth. There were a few psychoactive AEs in the patients who received active drug, which included daydreaming, abnormal dreams, agitation, and depressed mood or irritability. 2 placebo-treated patients had psychoactive adverse events, which, you know, were just something that happened to those patients, not related to the placebo, which were anxiety and insomnia. Nobody reported euphoria in the entire study, which I thought was important. They looked at signal density for inflammatory cytokines using a computer program to sort of quantify the density and the intensity of staining for the inflammatory cells for things including CD4 positive cells, IL-13, IL-33, PPAR gamma levels, and CD8 and CD11C levels. And those last ones didn't have any change from baseline. CD11C is something that's produced sometimes on B cells that have increased memory function and dendritic cells. So those might be important in maintaining chronic inflammatory processes in an area. And they also showed with their skin biopsies that there was no significant difference in gene expression of cytokines interferon beta, interferon gamma, IL-31, and IL-4 between the 2 treatment groups. At baseline, on day 85, they did find a decrease in the patients that were treated with active drug in interferon beta and interferon gamma. And I thought that was an interesting thing to see those changes happen and be quantified by the immunostaining. They also saw that there was no decrease in the peripheral blood mononuclear cells mRNA expression for those cytokines. So it has to be something a little bit more nuanced that's causing the varying levels besides just gene transcription. And I think that it was also very interesting, the study that you cited about the healthy volunteers that had the study of the inflamed, irritated skin getting the benefit of around 15 milligrams of prednisone. I thought that was an interesting thing to contemplate because, as we know, 15 milligrams of prednisone a day can be able to control a lot of patients that have mild to moderate dermatomyositis, but there are also side effects that we have to be thoughtful about for that. One of the ways that they have also looked at the potential activity of lanabecin in dermatomyositis was to look at peripheral blood mononuclear cells of patients with dermatomyositis and stimulate those with something that ticks them off and makes them produce inflammatory cytokines. Some of the things they used were lipopolysaccharides to stimulate the cells, or they used something called a CPG, which are oligodeoxynucleotides. They're short, synthetic, single-stranded DNA molecules that have a prominent cytosine guanine repeat, which is a motif that's conserved and present in a lot of microorganisms, but is lacking in vertebrates. So our immune systems tend to identify those fairly readily as foreign. So I think this is something that could potentially be useful for the treatment of chronic inflammatory diseases. Of note, the phase 3 study for systemic sclerosis with this drug did not beat placebo, which caused some market disruptions for the company that makes this drug. I think it's called Corbus Pharma. I found that out when I was trying to look up the price of this medication, which I was not yet able to find. Did you find a price, Luke?
Well, I don't think it's available yet. So it's not approved for dermatomyositis or for systemic sclerosis, but it might be. And so I thought it was helpful to talk about it. And also, the other reasons I mentioned earlier, just kind of cool to see a cannabinoid in dermatology and learn about the system. Of course, this is sponsored by the company that makes the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's like not dramatic in these trials, but the cutaneous effects of dermatomyositis are notoriously difficult to treat. So we're taught, for example, that the rheumatologists can often get the systemic issues under control with their various concoctions, but it's really hard to get the cutaneous symptoms under control. So nice to have something that could potentially be used for it. Of course, I would be worried about the cost if this were to come to market, because 15 milligrams of prednisone is pretty cheap. 20 milligrams BID of lanabecin is probably pretty expensive. But hey, it's a cannabinoid. I know a guy.
Luke. Oh my goodness. Yeah, sometimes drugs like this are approved in other countries before they're approved in the United States. So I wasn't sure if it might exist in a structure where there's a price for it, like in Europe, but we don't know what it costs here.
I mean, there's definitely lots of states where marijuana is legal to use recreationally. I don't think in either of our states.
Nope.
Can you study just recreational marijuana for some of these disorders?
That's an interesting question. I mean, we've reviewed articles where they've looked at something along those lines for chronic pruritus and stuff like that. Of course, the moieties that they're using into those settings do have psychoactive effects, which can be employment limiting for people. Some people do not desire to experience those for, you know, personal reasons. Some people have had trouble with addictive behaviors in the past. And while cannabinoid addiction to naturally, like non-souped up cannabinoids, is relatively low, as the products become more and more refined and have higher THC content, cannabinoid addiction disorder becomes more prevalent. And I think that current statistics say about 15% of regular users can become habituated. There's even a new medication that they've made to treat cannabinoid addiction, which is something that hadn't existed previously. So, you know, something to consider, but not an available option for everybody. And even studying it in the state of Texas has been really difficult. I have a researcher I've wanted to work with who has a mouse model for cancer-induced or cancer chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. And we wanted to look at the potential for CB2 analog to help modulate that. But studying that kind of thing in the state of Texas is still quite prohibitive.
I ran into something similar here. I had a student who wanted to study some kind of cannabinoid cream for atopic dermatitis, and there was just so much more paperwork. We decided to drop it. Also, this lanabecin thing, patients did have some psychoactive side effects, so maybe not so targeted at CB2 as we would like. And come on, if I'm taking a cannabinoid and I get weird, creepy dreams, but not euphoria, give me a break. All right, I think we got time for one more here. So I'm going to talk about botulinum toxin injections as an effective treatment for patients with intertriginous Hailey-Hailey or Dariey disease, an open-label 6-month pilot interventional study. This is out of a journal called Orphanet Journal of Rare Diseases. The authors include Isabel Dreyfus and Juliet, I'm going to mispronounce it, Mazirou-Hautier out of France. So first of all, shout out to Dr. Lindsay Wilson, a local dermatologist here, who clued me into this one. So Hailey-Hailey disease and Darier's disease. Usually you see these in adults, but they're still genoderms. So, you know, we pediatric dermatologists love our genoderms. They're pretty uncommon. I've probably had like 3 or 4 patients total who've had either of these diseases. Michelle, how often do you see these down in Texas?
We see some, like I would say at least a couple cases a year.
Well, they're often spoken of in the same breath because they're both caused by mutations in calcium channel proteins. Pimping Bill, are you paying attention? So the mutations in Hailey-Hailey are ATP2C1, and in Darier's disease, ATP2A2.
I have a silly way I remember this.
Please.
Okay, so Hailey-Hailey is not rare, but not terribly common. But I guarantee to my derm residents that while they're in dermatology residency, they're going to get 2C1. Ah, ha, ha, ha. They're going to get 2C1 in their dermatology residency. And I always thought that Darier's sounded a little bit like Cockney, you know? So I'd hate to have Darier's. So it's like A2, like.
I love it. Well, they can both present with primarily intertriginous findings. So intertriginous is the major skin folds, including eroded plaques, bad smell, which we call malodor, pain, susceptibility to infection, and can, as you might guess, have a significant impact on quality of life. Botulinum toxin. I'm going to just call it Botox. Nobody's sponsoring us. There's a lot of different botulinum toxin injections out there, but Botox has been reported in a few patients to be helpful, and this is a larger case series kind of looking at it. This was an open-label trial in 30 adult patients. 26 had Hailey-Hailey disease, 4 had Darier's disease, and they got botulinum toxin A, actual Botox in this case, diluted to 2.5 units per 0.1 ml, which is usually the strength I use when I treat hyperhidrosis, but I think usually when we're using it cosmetically, it's 4 units per 0.1 ml. Michelle, you use way more than I do on your patients. Do you feel like that's correct?
So the package dilution is 4 units per 0.1 ml. I like when I'm doing it for hyperhidrosis, especially if I'm doing it for like a bilateral process, to hydrate a 100 unit vial with 5 milliliters, because then that gives you 5 mLs. And I divide those up into like 2.5, basically, syringes per side, for most indications for hyperhidrosis that results in a satisfactory distribution of product, unless your patient is very large or has a high severity of sweating.
So then you're doing like, what, 3.5 units per 0.1 ml or something? It's less than 4, but not as low as 2.5?
Well, so usually we are suspending the 100 unit vial with 2.5 milliliters of bacteriostatic saline. So that gives us the 0.1 per. Does that make sense?
Normally, if you got 100 units, you put in 2.5 mls of saline, and that's how you get to 4 units per 0.1 ml. So you're putting in twice as much.
Yes.
So I guess you get
2 units per 0.1
ml. 2 units. Okay, so it's about the same.
Yeah.
And so they used up to 200 units per patient. And just like how I do hyperhidrosis, these patients were injected in a grid, so about 1 to 2 centimeters apart with each little dermal injection. It sounds very similar to treating hyperhidrosis. And the affected area, most of them were in the axillae. For pain control, they had them put on Emla about 30 minutes ahead of time. So people did get better, often within the first month. Both symptoms and quality of life improved. There was quite the range of improvement, anywhere from 24 to 93%. And these improvements generally persisted even at a 6-month follow-up after a single session. That's pretty good. However, a lot, 37% of the Hailey-Hailey patients relapsed during the 6 months observation period, even though they initially responded well. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what's interesting is you'll see persistence or recurrence of the disease around the treatment area. So you can kind of see where the treatment is working. And then right around the periphery, it's almost like a negative space thing of where the disease activity comes back.
So you've done this procedure on some of these patients.
I have a kind of family of Hailey-Hailey patients that's in this area. So we have a pretty good cohort. I misspoke earlier. I forgot about the like group of patients that we're treating with the Botox. But the cool thing about the Botox treatments is that the patients tend to also have kind of discomfort improvement. So like a lot of patients suffer from pain with Hailey Hailey. And what was interesting to me was that the pain got better faster than the skin disease got better. But it kind of makes sense because there's a local effect of Botox on inflammatory processes, especially like mast cell signaling and things like that. So that was kind of interesting to me, kind of from a pathophysiologic standpoint.
So you have a group of patients who are already doing well on this treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So these patients in their study who relapsed, they point out these were the most severely affected patients, and they wonder if maybe the relapse was because they were required to stop other therapies before enrolling in this study. Also, since they were the most severe, maybe they would have responded to higher doses of Botox or perhaps more frequent injections. 27% of patients reported a significant discharge of clear fluid from the area after treatment that persisted for a month. Have your patients talked about that?
I don't know if they're just so happy to get the treatment that they don't complain about things, but I have not had that complaint. I wonder if that's the saline kind of leaking back out through the sort of improperly covered skin, like that, or the skin has a incomplete barrier. So I wonder if it's that. That's an interesting question.
Authors weren't quite sure either. And interestingly, this clear fluid discharge is described in their paper both as mild, doesn't sound so bad, and also as debilitating. That sounds pretty bad. I suppose perhaps you can have something that's mild, but you know, it still prevents you from doing the things you want to do, so it could be considered debilitating. Overall, 70% of patients were satisfied or very satisfied. It's not so bad. Also, you know, Botox injections are pretty safe. They point out that sweating probably worsens a lot of the symptoms in these patients, so that could be one reason why Botox is helpful. However, many patients experienced a return of sweating and malodor after the first month, but their overall efficacy was still good. So maybe it's like you say, it can impact some of the inflammatory molecules or some of the neurons or something. Limitations, of course, there was no control group, and natural disease fluctuations are significant, so perhaps these patients enrolled just when they were really bad and they naturally weren't so bad by the end. The old regression to the mean phenomenon. They point out that surgical ablation may still be the right option in a lot of patients because it can potentially be more permanent and can treat a large area. Have you used that with like CO2 laser or something in any of your patients?
Yes, we've tried the CO2 laser for a couple of different patients and one patient that actually has an epidermal nevus with Derrier's in it. And the epidermal nevus patient did the best, which doesn't super duper surprise me because the density of the mutated cells for that patient is smaller and she has more normal cells kind of surrounding it. Whereas the patients with Derrier's, the whole skin surface has it and it's just the intertriginous areas that have the deleterious effects because of friction. But the cool thing about it is that if you do that with the like Botox therapy, like if you do the Botox, I like to like let the Botox be present for at least a couple of days before I do something resurfacing, just so that I don't have the possibility that edema fluid will wash the Botox into areas I didn't intend for it to go. In the axilla, you think about like the brachial plexus and making sure you're not going to cause like nerve dysfunction or muscle weakness or anything like that. But I found that the patients that had the Botox treatment and then the CO2 actually healed faster, which is kind of
and
cool.
The brachial plexus thing, you maybe worry about that a little bit with lasers or with Botox or both or not really either.
Not with lasers. I don't think you're getting anywhere close to deep enough with that. High doses of Botox in the axilla for some patients have correlated with weakness, but most of the time when you have weakness related to Botox for hyperhidrosis, it's in the hands, and it's usually with higher dose.
Yeah, the brachial plexus is way down there.
It's deep.
That I guess
deep.
Botox can diffuse.
Well, it's a theoretical concern. It just makes me cautious to, honestly, it's probably overkill, but like, for example, I would not do CO2 resurfacing on a person's face on the same day that I would do Botox, because if you've ever done CO2 on somebody's face, they swell up like a kind of puffer fish usually the next day, and all that edema fluid might move things around where you didn't intend for them to go. So it's probably more just little dogma.
Sorry, say again?
It's probably just me following dogma there, but it makes me feel better to wait a couple of days.
That makes sense. So a couple other notes. Botox has also been helpful in pachyonychia congenita, if you have any of those patients. Botox, of course, works by blocking the release of acetylcholine, which we know stimulates eccrine sweat glands. And based on data from other disorders like spasticity, max Botox per session is about 1,000 units, or 30 units per kilogram, whichever is lower. The authors of this study had no conflicts of interest. that's all we got for today, guys. So you're probably hanging on the edge of your seat about menopause and derm. We'll make sure we hit that one next time. And thanks for joining us today. Thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thank you to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks very much to all of our members of Team Dermosphere who keep many aspects of this podcast moving along. Yes, thank you too. Morgan Dykman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Aparna Nayak, Neha Deo, Haley Walsh, Angie Wong, and Laura Dela Cruz. You guys do a lot for us. One thing you do is keep our social media accounts moving along. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which has links to all of our original articles, as well as our entire archive available for free. As a reminder, please come out and hang out with us at the University of Utah Dermatology Echo virtually one Friday out of every month. And also come see me in Idaho and hang out and learn some dermatology, a couple meetings there in September. And you can find some of our content on video through the ViewMedi platform. Also, I wanted to let you guys know that I'm going to be at the Society for Pediatric Dermatology meeting in mid-July. So if you happen to be there around July 14th or 15th in Asheville, North Carolina, come say hello. Michelle is going to be at the World Congress of Dermatology. It's possible you'll actually already have returned by the time this airs. But if not, if you're hanging out in Singapore, say hi to Michelle.
Woo!
Michelle, play us out with your Snoop Dogg reference.
Oh, no. You want me to just do 1, 2, 3 into the phone? Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the
top. Last time I think you said, and just chill.
Until the next episode. Oh my god, I would have gotten there eventually, but it would have taken me the whole song. My apologies. So
okay,
just
one more
chill.
Chance.
Okay, so just chill. Till the next episode. Doo-doo.